What a deal. First, before I forget, I would like to thank the committee. I'd like to thank Milt and Bob and all of the committee for just a wonderful time. We've been true tourists this weekend. We've seen parts of Tennessee that I never dreamed I'd get to see. And anybody that has any questions about the library, if they'll see me after the meeting, I'll be glad to share with them. That's kind of an inside thing. This meeting was supposed to have been held at a nudist colony this evening, but it had to be canceled because everybody was comparing and nobody was identifying. In lieu of that, I guess I'm to tell you guys in a general way what I used to be like and what happened to me and what I'm like today. I'm going to tell you. You're going to have to wait. I'm not there yet. See, I forgot to thank Grace, and I forgot to thank Bob. They did a beautiful job, and I'm certainly glad I was here to hear that. My name's Al Farley, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Edgewood Group in Charleston, West Virginia. I'm very proud of that group. I hope to get to tell you a little more about it as I go on. But first, if I'm going to start in the beginning, I was going to tell you I was born in Charleston, West Virginia. I was born there in 1925. I'm 76 years old. My mother was a Baptist. My father was a Catholic. A bad combination. But in West Virginia, the Baptist ruled, and the Catholic, he didn't go back to church. My father never darkened the doors of a church again. But I made up for it with my mother at the Baptist temple in Charleston, West Virginia. Any time that the doors of the Baptist temple were open, my mother and I were there. I was baptized by Dr. Kemper. Now, that doesn't mean a thing to anybody in this room except me. But according to my mother and my Aunt Virginia, if Dr. Kemper baptized you, you had a ticket to heaven. And early on, Dr. Kemper was, he baptized me and I went to the Baptist temple. I'm not saying that they taught, but I'm saying that my understanding of God at that time was a vengeful God. I pictured a ledger and a bookkeeper and a big book, and there was a sheet in there that had Al Farley's name on it. And long before I took a drink, that sheet of misdeeds was full. I lied early. I lied long before I took a drink. I cheated when I was, to give you an example of my character, when I was real little, I'm talking six, a friend of mine and I would go up to a corner grocery store and we'd buy a package of Kool-Aid. It cost a nickel. We'd take it home, very carefully open it, and make Kool-Aid with it, put sand in the package, take it back and exchange it for another flavor. So there was a certain amount of larceny long before I took a drink. My dad made homebrew, and there was, at that time when I was, well, of course, in 25 to up until about 30-something, there was prohibition. Nobody had it. You couldn't go to the store and buy a six-pack. If you had anything to drink, you made it. So Dad made homebrew, and it sat in the basement by the hot water heater, and it was in a crock, and it he'd put yeast and malt and water and sugar and put a piece of cheesecloth over the top, and it would ferment, and When it was ready to bottle, he could tell by the way it bubbled and the foam went down, and we'd bottle it. And I'd get to put the caps on, and sometimes I'd get to start the siphon. And sometimes I'd start the siphon when Dad wasn't there. My first drink was homebrew, but it didn't cause me any problems. I went to grade school in Charleston, went to junior high school. And in junior high school, a boy that I chummed around with, we raked up 87 cents and got a man to buy a pint of Mr. Boston rocking chair at the liquor store. And that was my first store whiskey. And it was, I'm not going to stand here and tell you it tasted good, because it tasted horrible. But I guess early on I drank primarily for effect, because I've heard it said, and I so identified with, a man that said he felt like he had come off the assembly line on a Friday, and on Monday they had come back and went in there with a torque wrench and tightened everything up. That's sort of the way I felt, that after I took a couple of drinks out of that pint, somebody had gone in there with a torque wrench and tightened everything up, and I felt good. I felt good about myself. I felt good about you. I felt good about everything. I went to Charleston High School and got in a little trouble with drinking. This was before they knew anything about the attention deficit disorder. If they had known, I would have been a candidate. I was not a scholar. I liked to party. I liked to have a good time. I joined a drinking fraternity in high school. They had just finished a new high school in Charleston on the west side. And after one semester at Charleston High School, this principal suggested that I go to the west side and go to this new school and get a new start. And I did. I went to Stonewall Jackson and I attended there one semester. And the principal there suggested that I go back to Charleston High School. Well, this third semester, they found liquor in my locker, and I was drunk at school, and I was expelled from the school system. And my mother and dad, they sacrificed to send me to a military school. And I went to a military school in Virginia. And they drove me down, and they pulled around this circular drive in front of the administration building. And when we pulled up, there was a car parked in front of us, and it had West Virginia license plates. And we went in, and unbeknownst to me, the guy that I told you about that we bought that pint with, he had been in a little trouble, and he was also enrolling in this military school. So we became roommates. And things went a little better in military school than they did at home. They were a little harder to con, but the drinking continued when the opportunity presented itself. Still not a scholar. And World War II was starting. They were drafting people. It was in 1942. And in 1943, before we were 17 years old, this roommate of mine and I, we came back and enlisted in the Marine Corps. And we went through boot camp together. And there was no drinking, of course, at boot camp. And after boot camp, he was assigned sea duty, and I was assigned to the rifle range at Parris Island. I stayed at Parris Island for about 6 months and then was assigned to the combat range at Camp Lejeune. Coached at the combat range for another 4 to 5 months, and then went with the 3rd Marine Division, a replacement battalion, and joined them at the Marianas. I have no big war stories to tell you. The liquor was always important. It was important that I have something to drink. When I was in school, if there was a dance, it was more important that I have a bottle, then I'd worry about a date. Booze was important to me, and I didn't realize the significance of that until I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, on those of you, and I know that there's some in here that are familiar with the rations that they had overseas. In those rations, there was a thing called a fruit bar. It was about 6 inches long, about 1 inch square. They'd taken plums and raisins and dates and God knows what all, and they'd pressed it into a little block. And we had opened hundreds of boxes of rations to get that fruit bar. And we'd throw that fruit bar in a barrel that the Japanese had shipped fish heads over there in, I guess, along with water and sugar if you could get it. And let it sit there a while, and it was just exactly like Dad's homebrew. It would foam and bubble for a while, and then you could take your canteen cup and just scrape that scum off the top and get you a dipper full of it. And if you drank primarily for effect, it worked great. In fact, the effect was about the same as J&B. The after effect was a lot worse, but the primary effect was good. Got an honorable discharge from the Marine Corps. Came back to West Virginia. Joined the 5220 Club. That was an arrangement they made for veterans that they paid you $20 a week for 52 weeks. Mine was spent at the pool room. A group of us, all in the same boat, would at noon, we had folding chairs we'd take down to the corner of Capitol Street and Courier, the main thoroughfare in Charleston. We'd set our chairs down at noon, watch the girls go to lunch, watch them come back to work, and then we'd go back to the pool room. I had dated a girl and before I went into the service, and anyway, we got married, and I went to work. And I went to night school at a college in Charleston called Morris Harvey. And we had four children. We had a daughter and a son and two daughters. Fairly close order. And I got a job in a plant, one of the chemical plants in the valley. And I finally became an instrument tech, and I worked on instrumentation in the plant. It was a chemical plant, a lot of distillation columns and measuring temperatures and pressures and flows. And the son, the second child, started having troubles in 1956. And by 1958, he was having convulsions, and we couldn't find out what was the matter with him. And never did really determine what the problem was, had him all over the country. And Johns Hopkins said that he had a degenerative brain disorder and that they gave him 6 months to live. And he's still alive, so they missed the diagnosis. He's retarded, but his mother couldn't take care of him. And in 1965, he was put into a home in West Virginia called the Colin Anderson Center. It's a state-operated facility. And that same year, I was offered a job with a company that's as a manufacturer's representative selling instruments, the company that called on our plant. I talked with them many times and asked me if I'd like to go to work with them and sell instrumentation up in the Mid-Ohio Valley, up from Ravenswood, West Virginia, up through New Martinsville. Lots of plants, lots of power plants, chemical plants. Said I'd be my own boss. I'd make a lot of money, and they'd take care of expenses and set my own hours. And what a deal. My drinking had continued. I was never missed work because of drinking, but On weekends, vacations, always had a drink. On evenings, I'd have a drink. But never any serious trouble with it. But in 1965, I took this job, resigned from the plant. They gave me a bunch of credit cards, and they gave me a car, gave me some catalogs, and they told me to go up to Mid-Ohio Valley and sell their products. So I bid everybody adieu, and I got in the car, and I drove up to Parkersburg, which is on the Ohio River, right across the river from Belpre, Ohio, Marietta, Ohio, in that area, geographically. I'm trying to let you know about where I was set up headquarters. You also need to understand West Virginia liquor laws. You could not go into a bar and buy a drink legally. But if they had a club and you were a member of that club, you could buy a drink. And that was the way to get around this drink thing. So anyway, I went up to Parkersburg and I found this. Don't be afraid of that bat. He's not going to land in anybody's hair. I stopped at this new motel they had just built up there called the Uptowner Inn. And I registered, and they gave me my room key, and they gave me a little card that said I was a member of the Purple Pussycat Lounge. So I immediately took my things up to the room and went down in the basement to examine the Purple Pussycat Lounge. Pardon me. And I thought I had really arrived. It wasn't a very big place. It was a room not quite as, about maybe the same size as from this chair to the back wall. A bar, jukebox, little shifty bartender, couple of scantily clad barmaids. And I just thought, no, this is it. I have arrived. And I set up my housekeeping right there at the Purple Pussycat Lounge. It was a result of the Purple Pussycat Lounge that I made my first jail. I was thrown into the Wood County Jail one morning about 2:30, 3 o'clock, for drunk and disorderly. And I can't tell you how humiliating it was. I told you about Dr. Kemper. I told you about the Baptist Temple. I had not been raised to be thrown into a jail cell with a bunch of rapists and murderers and thieves and God knows what all. And there I was right in the middle of them. Well, the fellow that owned the motel, he came and bailed me out because he's losing money every minute I'm in that jail. My typical day was to get up around noon, have a drink, go to the Holiday Inn down the road to a place called the Executive Club because they opened for lunch. And I could drink martinis. It was there that I learned how to fold napkins for the dinner crowd at the Holiday Inn with Thelma, the waitress, while drinking martinis waiting for the Purple Pussycat to open at 4. Well, I made that Pardon me. I made that jail several other times. Always drunk in something. Drunken driving, drunken disorderly. And each time that I went back to that jail, it got a little easier. The last time I was in that jail, it was sort of like a reunion. Whatever happened to old Bob? Well, he's doing hard time now, you know. That didn't go on all the time. Once in a while, I'd make a sales call. Had to. But it was very seldom, and the people that I called on drank. If they didn't drink, they didn't go to lunch. This lasted until 1968, and that company fired me. They said I was the only salesman they ever had whose expenses were more than his gross sales. Well, I come back to Charleston. The girls had kind of scattered. I told you the son is at Colin Anderson. My oldest daughter, she had gotten married. My middle daughter, my flower child, she went up to Minnesota to learn how to make leather and went out to California to smoke dope and just wandering around the country. Youngest daughter had an apartment with another girl. So things were not good at home. And I was under a lot of pressure, and I figured that what I needed to do was just to get out of that environment. And I knew I was drinking too much. I mean, I was a daily drinker. I had to have something to drink. I found the early, that morning drink way, way before it became popular. I knew what would straighten me out. I never considered beer a drink. I would much rather have an ice-cold beer in the morning than I would a glass of orange juice. It just sort of started things right, better than orange juice ever did. So I got a job with a company, a mine mill supply house, the mine mill supplies, rope, soap, dope, ladders, and I had one account, and that was the state of West Virginia. I called on the various purchasing departments that bought for various groups in the state, and they're all located in Charleston, which is the capital of West Virginia. So I called on the purchasing at West Virginia. Well, I found a guy that bought stuff that I sold on Monday that drank just exactly like I did. And on Monday, we would go to a little place called Clement's up on the river and wouldn't have to say a word, just walk in and they'd bring a pitcher of martinis and put them on the table. And if they were gone, they'd bring another. On Wednesday, I had a guy that bought another bunch of commodities, and on Wednesday, we'd go to Kanawha City and park by the tennis courts. He drank Bourbon Supreme. Saved a little yellow tassels off the knob bottle. I don't know what he did with them, but he saved them. And we'd sit up there and drink Bourbon Supreme and watch them play tennis in the summer and watch it snow in the winter. And on Friday, I had a guy that liked to drink rye whiskey. So I'd buy Rittenhouse, and we'd go up to the cemetery, which overlooks Charleston, and sit up there and drink rye whiskey. And this went on and till they went bankrupt. And I'm out of work. But it was during this time that, I told you I was under a lot of stress and I moved out of the house. If I could get away from her, that I would be less tense and I wouldn't have to drink as much and things would smooth out. And coincidentally, the same time I moved out and got into this apartment, they introduced half gallons to West Virginia. And I felt then that that was my answer. If I had a half gallon and only drank down to the top of the P, you know, on pop-off, then down to the bottom of the P, and then down to the V, and if you do it that way, that half gallon should last me a week. Never worked. Never worked. Somebody broke into my apartment, I'm sure, and drank, because I would be way below the V the next morning. So it wasn't working. And I got kicked out of the apartment, because if you don't pay the rent, you get kicked out. But while I was in that apartment, one day there was a knock on the door. Normally, I wouldn't go to the door in the daytime because I had a lot of bad checks out. I was behind in the rent. But I was just at that point, you know, invisible and bulletproof. And there came the knock on the door, and I opened the door, and there was a little fellow standing there with real thick glasses, and he smiled, and he said, "My name's Bob B." And he said, "We've got a mutual friend that's concerned about your drinking." And I invited him in, offered him a drink, and he didn't want a drink. He said he was from Alcoholics Anonymous. He said he'd been in 150-some jails, and he'd been in 50-some institutions. I thought, my God, I got him in my apartment. And he told me about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, you know, somebody had been institutionalized that much, they needed Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never been in an institution. I'd been in jail, but I'd never been in an institution. So I thanked him and he left. And I never thought any more about Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, again, my pattern, it got worse. It progressed, just like they said it would. But they didn't tell me that until I got here. This is where I found out about the progression. I made Kanawha County Jail, made South Charleston Jail, my most spectacular arrest. I told you about the funny liquor laws. West Virginia, they closed the liquor stores at that time at 8 o'clock. You couldn't get in there after 8. And they shut them down. 8 o'clock, they were closed. It's 5 till 8. I'm trying to get there before they close because I am low. And I broadside a police car. And there's blue lights. I could have robbed a bank and wouldn't have gotten as many cops out as I did hitting that one police car. Anyway, back to jail and on and on and on. I get kicked out of this apartment and I have no place to go. I go to a hotel in downtown Charleston called The Holly. You can't visit it now because they tore it down. But if you could have visited it then, you wouldn't want to have been there. The Holly was not, it was a flea bag hotel, is what it was, and run by a super guy named Frankie Beltre. Frankie's still alive, but Frankie wasn't too strict about the rent. And of course, the accommodations weren't all that great. But there was a bunch of guys in there just like me that were helpless and hopeless, that were unemployable, that begged, borrowed, steal, do whatever you had to do to get a drink. I had a briefcase. I told you about my sales job. Well, my briefcase was just like new. I had a pen light. I had an eye chart. I'd go to Kresge's, Woolworth's, Cohen's drugstore. I'd buy a pair of reading glasses. I'd steal a dozen pair. And I had my briefcase fitted with eye chart, reading glasses of various strengths, and my pen light. And I'd go off up and down George's Creek, Kelly's Creek, Cabin Creek, Paint Creek, all the little hollows around Charleston, calling on people They were older people. They're my age now, but they were older people then. And asked them if they had any trouble reading the big book. And if they did, I'd look in their eyes with my pen light and I'd let them read the eye chart, and I'd fit them with glasses, and I'd sell them a pair of glasses, and then I'd have enough for a pint or a fifth, depending on how much money they had to spend it or how much glasses cost. Well, this was a bad way to make a living, but I wasn't really making a living, but I was making enough to drink. You know, when you get as many as six guys and there's you're going to buy a night train or Irish Rose or a fifth of wine, just enough to get you settled down, it's a bad way to live. Bad way to live. Well, I had reached a point where I weighed about 150 pounds. I couldn't keep anything down. Nothing would stay down. And the fellow that worked for the state that I told you about that I drank with on Monday, he made arrangements to get me into the Veterans Hospital in Huntington, West Virginia. And I went to the VA. They found some problems with my pancreas, and they did some surgery, and they told me not to drink. And they didn't have an AA meeting there at that time. But it was laying in a bed on a ward in Huntington, West Virginia, in a veteran hospital, that it dawned on me that maybe my problem was alcohol. Really, that was a revelation, because up to that point, alcohol was a solution for any problem I had. I don't care what it was. If I had a serious problem, it took more, but it took alcohol to solve any problem. And if I had enough alcohol, I could solve it. Security to me was an unbroken seal on a fifth of whiskey. And total abject fear was to have one drink left and not know where the next drink was going to come from. And that was fear like I don't have to describe to you, because if you're an alcoholic like me, you know. Well, I decided maybe booze was my problem, but I didn't do anything about it other than I came back to Charleston. The kids had gone, as I told you. Told the wife that I had decided that I couldn't drink. That made it about unanimous. So I went back home. And this was in 1972, about June. Well, later in 72, about November, I ran across that fellow that I went in the Marine Corps with. And he looked good. And he told me he hadn't had a drink for 7 years. And I asked him how he did it, and he told me he had done it in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I asked him what I had to do to join. And he told me that the only requirement for membership was a desire to stop drinking. So I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a sobriety date of December the 7th of 1972. I haven't had a drink or a mood-altering drug since that first meeting. And as you were told earlier, that in itself is a miracle. Now, the vids would go, I can see that first meeting. I'm not one of these people that was drugged to Alcoholics Anonymous and didn't want to be there. I wanted what you had. I wanted it the very first night I walked in the door. There were people there that were sober, that were happy, and that's exactly what I looked for every time I took a drink. I was just looking for some happiness and peace of mind. I didn't set out to be a falling down drunk. I wanted to be like that guy on the back of the magazine with the dog and the fire and the drink in his hand. It wasn't me, but that's what I wanted to be. And I found exactly what I was looking for in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can see that my first meeting, Grace was at my first meeting. A guy who was my mentor, my sponsor, my my roommate, my drinking buddy, he was at the first meeting. A fellow named George, the chairman was a guy named Alex who died drunk. And I can see the faces around that table tonight. I said, they told me if I wanted to join that group, all I had to do was put my name in the book. And it would stay there until I took it out. I was the only one that could put it in, and I was the only one that could take it out. So I signed the Edgewood membership book that night, and I became a member of Edgewood. Been a member ever since. If I can hang in there until December the 7th, I'll have 29 years. I'm trying to catch up with Grace. See, it sounds good, the applause, but I really can't take any credit for that because I've been given a gift. God allowed me to see that window of opportunity to find what you heard about here this morning. Two guys gave to us. In 1973, that company that fired me asked me if I'd go back to work for them. Don't ask me why. Don't ask me why. The only reason I can think of is that the fellow that owned the company was a drunk. A young man. They found him dead in his apartment 3 days later. He was 45 years old of alcohol poisoning. Anyway, they asked me if I'd go back to work and told me I couldn't go above Ravenswood. No way I could go up to Parkersburg or any of that part of the state. So I accepted their offer, and I went back to work for their company, selling instrumentation. Well, this company is headquartered in Pittsburgh. They had offices in Cleveland, had offices in Batavia or Rochester, New York. I had offices in Charleston, West Virginia, and the home office in Pittsburgh. From 1973 until 96, I was probably their top salesman 13 or 14 years. And that was strictly because of the principles of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. No other reason. Certainly I wasn't a bit smarter. In fact, if anything, I lost a lot of brain cells. The technology had advanced and I hadn't really kept up with it. But I was honest with my customers. I didn't lie to them about anything. If they wanted it tomorrow and it was going to take 6 months to get it, I'd tell them 6 months. If it wouldn't work on their application, I'd say, don't buy it, it won't work. And that's the only thing I can attribute it to. This office that I went back to work for was just a block and a half from the Holly Hotel. And we'd walk to lunch occasionally, and I'd walk by the Holly. And there were guys that I'd panhandled with. They were given the same opportunity because I told them, there's an answer. You never have to take another drink. You never have to take another drink. There's an answer for our disease. With a few simple steps. Well, those guys are gone now, and they went one by one. And the fellow that I worked for, we had worked together before. He knew of my problem, And he knew of our solution. And he was a very understanding boss. If I was at work and the phone rang and it was 12-step call, he'd say, go on, I'll take care of whatever's here. One day in 1973, in the fall, he was. We had a sales meeting in Pittsburgh. And he said that my sponsor, he came in the office a lot, and we talked, and he said, there's an assembly in Parkersburg, an AA fall assembly, a business meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the area, get together, and the GSRs decide the future of the fellowship. So he said, we'll go to Pittsburgh, and I'll drop you off there Friday night. And I said, that'd be wonderful. So on a Friday evening, coming back from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, he stopped at the Uptowner Inn in Parkersburg, West Virginia, and he let me out of the car. And I went to the desk, and I said, where is the AA meeting? She said, go down the stairs and turn left. And I said, left? That was the Purple Pussycat Lounge. She said, they're not there anymore. They're having the AA meeting down there. Yeah. Well, I told you I joined the Edgewood group. That's my home group. Let me tell you a little bit about the Edgewood group. Well, once a year in November, we have a bean dinner. We have probably 30 members. I can't tell you how many members have signed that book. There's no way to tell. Oh, there is a way. You can ask Grace, but we have about 30 active members. In November, we do a bean dinner and send the proceeds to GSO because it's gratitude month. And we average anywhere from $300 to $500 a year. We've been doing that for about 20 years now. Very service-oriented group. Out of that group, we've had five delegates. We've had seven area chairmen. We believe that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is more than just the recovery program. It's the whole package. There's recovery, vital. There's unity, vital. There's service, vital. And I think the whole thing, every side of the triangle makes the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that I'm fortunate that I was given the opportunity to find that group, because they're a very structured group. 32 years, I believe, there's nobody has ever repeated being chairman of a Thursday night group. We believe in rotation. The I got involved in service fairly early. It was washing ashtrays at that time. We don't have that problem anymore. Washing cups, the styrofoam took care of those. But got involved in being busy, doing stuff in the group. I was allowed to be a GSR for the group. And then I was allowed to be a district committeeman. And then I was allowed to be the chairman for the area. Then I got to be delegate, I followed Grace. I was panel 29. The great honor. No way I could ever, I didn't expect it. I'll be forever grateful for that opportunity. I had an order of things of importance to me in my Alcoholics Anonymous journey. My first meeting was very important. There was a drunk there. He wanted to get sober. He had been to Alcoholics Anonymous before, He didn't have time to fool with those steps. He just wanted to get sober. And they were pounding on the table, telling him to get down on his knees. And he was bad-mouthing them. And it was just chaos. And Guy thought, well, now Al will never be back. This is no kind of way to have an AA meeting. I thought it was fantastic. I wouldn't give anything for that first AA meeting. I thought that the opportunity to serve our area as a delegate was probably the greatest thing that would happen in my AA career. But let me tell you, probably the thing that was most important, that 11 years ago, the phone rang one night, and this middle daughter that I told you about, my flower child, the pot smoker, the alcoholic, she had worked around Charleston in all the bars. She was a barmaid, bartender, drunk. And I did not hound her. I told her that her dad had found an answer. If she ever needed help, please call me. And that was about it. And about 11 years ago, the phone rang one night, and she said that I'm in trouble. Well, of course, Dad knew she was in trouble. She'd been in trouble for a long time, but this was the first time she'd asked for help. And we put Catherine in the car, and we went off to Hope Valley. They have the guy runs that place is very sharp. He has a women's division at Pilot Mountain, and he has a men's division at Dobson, and never the two mix. So there's a lot more sobriety than there is hanky-panky. And so anyway, she picked up an 11-year chip at her home group, Marge, from her sponsor, Grace. You see, I was told early on that we don't have idols in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't put anybody on a pedestal. But I have a hero in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's not on a pedestal, but he's a hero. I had the opportunity to sponsor an attorney, young man. Like I told John this evening, hell, everybody's a young man anymore. tax attorney, one of the top 100 in the country. Brilliant guy. Active in service. He was our area treasurer. Anyway. He had come downstairs early one morning, was going to a Bible study. He went to every Thursday morning, I believe. And he felt dizzy, and he fainted, and he struck his head on the edge of the fireplace. And he's quadriplegic. He didn't lose any of his mental capacity, but he's in a wheelchair. He has enough motion in his hand that he can steer the wheelchair. And he went to Atlanta for a spinal cord rehab down there, and then he came back to West Virginia to a rehab center at Institute. And we'd take meetings to Institute on Tuesday nights for John. And since it was his only meeting, we always gave him the opportunity to pick the topic. And his topic always dealt with what we could do to carry the message to the alcoholic that's still suffering. Never about John. So he had what I think maybe that AA stands for besides Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's attitude and acceptance. You see, for instance, first step, I accept the fact that I'm an alcoholic. I cannot successfully take a drink of liquor. Now, I think there's where attitude comes in. I could either say, poor me, or I can say, this is the greatest thing that ever happened to me because I'm not dependent on that bottle anymore. And I have today an attitude of gratitude. I'm the most grateful guy you're ever going to have stand before you, because I've been given a gift that I couldn't describe. If I'd been given the opportunity to write down what I expected from Alcoholics Anonymous the night I got here, I would have shortchanged myself so bad. Well, this marriage thing, I had the steps to work, and for 8 years I tried to make amends and do what I could do to set my life right. I'd done some things that I was not at all proud of. I had done some things that I should have been in prison for. My eyeglasses, that was not the extent of my sales. I sold some stuff that I should have done. Not dope. I didn't do dope. I'm sort of like, I'm strictly an alcoholic. That's all I know about. But I sold some franchises that were not franchises, and I took some money that was illegal, and because of this program, I was able to rectify that so that I can walk down any street in the world today and look anybody I see in the eye, and it's strictly because of Alcoholics Anonymous and what I've been given through the 12 steps. I kind of envy the new people, the guy that got the big book and the young lady that had 44 days. What a marvelous journey you have ahead of you. What a great life you've got in front of you. I tried to work the steps, tried to make those amends to the wife. It didn't work. I believe there's a difference between making amends and doing penance. I got a divorce. And then I met, well, of course, I knew Grace. Grace was at my first meeting. Grace and I have had, since about 1981, had a great life. We have the same interests. I talk to an alcoholic every day. I have no secrets from Grace anymore. My sponsor, he died this year. He died with Alzheimer's. He was very important to my sobriety. If you don't have one, I urge you to get one. I don't have one right now, but I will have before the year's out. I got another addiction in Alcoholics Anonymous. I became addicted to golf. My golf game's described in the big book. It says we keep doing the same thing, expecting different results. About 18 years ago, it started with about 12 guys at a place called Groundhog Mountain down in Virginia, all members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went on Memorial Day weekend. Went down there and had meetings on Friday and Saturday night and played golf on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That's expanded now. We'll be meeting the Memorial Day weekend, the end of this month. There are 72 of us that will meet at Draper Valley. We'll meet again at Charlotte in August. We'll meet again at Santee in November. And then we'll meet at the beach in the 1st of March. So it's fun. It's good AA. And if any of you golfers, we have them as far away as Rochester, New York, and as far south as Florida. So if any of you want to Give it a whirl, see me, and I'll see that you get on the mailing list. I was told that I loved the statement. A guy said he tried to live in the world and visit AA, and it didn't work. Until he started living in AA and visiting the world, and then his life came together. And if you think about that, there's a lot of truth there. I don't believe I can just visit Alcoholics Anonymous whenever I feel like I'm in trouble. I think Alcoholics Anonymous is my life. Anything I have or ever hope to have, I owe it to AA. And I guess that's why I've told you some things that are not, they're my opinion, and I'm entitled to those, I believe. You see, I don't think alcoholic can be all things to all people. When it says that the hand of AA should always be there, and for that I'm responsible, and I believe that it should be. But I think if a person comes to Alcoholics Anonymous with an addiction other than alcohol, then we need to be there and tell them where they can find help. And I think if we tell somebody with an addiction other than alcoholism that their answer is in AA, that we're helping them commit suicide. I believe that the language is the hardest, one drunk sharing with another drunk. And I believe that's what was given to me. I was told the truth when I got here. They told me my life would change. They didn't say it was going to get better. It did get better, but they promised me it would change. And it did change. I've got a little card. There's a fellow named C.C. out of Canada that spoke at Cedar Lake some time back. And C said, and he took a paragraph from the forward to the 12 and 12. It says that AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. That's in the forward to the 12 and 12. And Cease gave his definition, not out of the big book, this is his, of what each of those principles for each of those steps was. And number one was honesty. Number two was hope. Number three was faith. Number four was courage. Number five was integrity. Six was willingness. Seven was humility. Eight was brotherly love. Nine was self-discipline. 10 was perseverance. 11 was the ever-presence of God. And 12 was service to our fellow man. And I'd heard about the principles ever since I'd been in AA, and that's Cease was the first guy that I ever heard say what he thought those principles were. And I took those from a tape that they'd made of Cease, and I've looked at them, and I believe that those are indeed, they suit me for the principles of the 12 steps. I don't know what else I can tell you. I can tell you that the reason I'm standing here tonight before you is because of a loving God and not the God that I understand as a child. I'm standing here tonight as a loving God that has done for me what I could not possibly do for myself. And I believe that he'll do that for anybody that wants it and asks for it. And I want to thank you again for allowing me to be with you tonight.